Hi, welcome to New Books in Politics. I'm your host, Jeff Bloodworth. The 2012 election was really remarkable for almost the total lack of debate about foreign policy and national security issues. And so this week, we're going to try to counteract that and have a serious discussion about national security and the politics of foreign policy. And in that vein, to do so, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, and we're going to be discussing two of her new books. And in addition to making us all feel very unproductive by having two books come out in the same year, what Dr. Kleinfeld does in her books is, I believe, she really neatly offers some policies and ideas that are going to address the national security issues of the 21st century. I mean, there's nothing new when I say that, you know, the national security challenges of the 20th century were all about big power rivalries. And the 21st century is obviously very different in that the national security challenges facing the U.S. are all about failed states and non-state actors that often find safe haven in these failed states or developing countries that have hit developmental snags. And so both of these books offer really concrete and seemingly to me doable policies that address these very central challenges of the 21st century. Now, the first book that Rachel has penned, Advancing the Rule of Law Abroad, The Next Generation of Reform. And in this, what Dr. Kleinfeld discusses are some new ideas and policies that are all devoted to establishing the rule of law in developing nations. And in this, I think, you know, Dr. Kleinfeld makes a very good point that the rule of law is the basis. This is what you need for developing countries to establish, you know, these kind of viable institutions to serve as the seedbed for economic growth. Now, the second book, which Dr. Kleinfeld co-wrote with Drew Sloan, is called Let There Be Light, Electrifying the Developing World with Markets and Distributed Energy. And this is a really interesting book in that what the authors claim is that energy, or the lack thereof, is one of these major drivers of insecurity in the developing world. In other words, in a place like Afghanistan, why is there so little economic growth? Well, I think what Dr. Kleinfeld has you know, neatly pointed out is, you know, it's the lack of energy, the lack of just basic electricity, you know, and instead of seeing this as some sort of like immense challenge that Americans cannot tackle, this book is devoted to talking about the very kind of small and doable policy innovations that Americans and our allies that we can unleash all across the developing world that will make the developing world a more secure area, which will unleash economic growth, which will in turn make Americans more secure and the global security environment more stable. Anyway, we're going to be discussing these two books, and I hope you enjoy our discussion. Rachel Kleinfeld, welcome to New Books in Politics. How are you doing?
I'm great. Great to be here. Thanks, Jeff.
Hey, no problem. First, I mean, how we start out is we just have our guests tell a little bit about themselves, educational background, professional background, that sort of thing.
Sure. So I was a Yale undergrad. I did my master's and my PhD at Oxford. But I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska, and that's a pretty rural frontier town, and that's probably the place that's closest to my heart. And I now split my time between Washington, D.C., where I run the Truman National Security Project as president, with Mike Breen, our executive director, and Colorado, which has beautiful mountains.
Do you want to tell us just a little bit about the Truman National Security Project?
Sure. Truman, we started it about 8 years ago. We saw the country heading in really a bad direction in foreign policy. And a group of us thought we need to build a new backbench of progressive leaders who care about national security, understand the stakes, and also understand the types of solutions that are needed for the 21st century. And from there, it's grown. So we're now really the hub for smart, progressive foreign policy and national security thinking for the best people in the next generation under 40. And good communications, messaging, and policy ideas.
Great. Well, today we're going to be, and you're going to be making everybody out there feel incredibly unproductive because we're going to be talking about two books instead of one. Let There Be. I thought we could start with Let There Be Light, and we're also going to be also talking about Advancing the Rule of Law Abroad. But we'll start with Let There Be Light in an election season when we're talking about foreign policy in very broad strokes. Your books are really sort of, you know, kind of the infrastructure, you know, the policy nitty gritty, it seems to me, of the foreign policy of the 21st century. And so maybe you can explain a little bit, start talking about, you know, the basic thesis of Let There Be Light. And, you know, so go ahead.
Sure. Actually, that's such an interesting idea. Let me telescope into it.
Okay.
Because I think you're absolutely right that the way I see the foreign policy of this century, we are for the first time as threatened by weak states as by strong states.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really had that before since the Middle Ages. You know, in the Middle Ages, we had highwaymen and pirates and all sorts of things like that. Well, we now have them again. And you have these fragile states that host terrorist networks. You have fragile states that can host zoonotic diseases that move from animals to humans and can become pandemics. You have fragile states where extremism can fester of various sorts, where nuclear weapons can become lost and get into the wrong hands. So all of a sudden, we have this new set of challenges in weak states, and we're very good, actually, at dealing with strong states. We're good at dealing with Iran and North Korea and problematic states like that. But we are not very good at dealing with these fragile states. So both of these books deal with that set of problems. So while they look very different on the surface, they're actually similar in that way. So Let There Be Light starts with the premise that we get a lot of security challenges from the underdeveloped world, these fragile states, and particularly from the energy resources that we choose to use. So our choice worldwide to fuel most of our cars with oil fuels oil states. Most of those oil states that survive on money from their oil means they don't collect many taxes from their people. That means they don't care much about their people's well-being. So you end up with very angry populaces in a lot of these oil states kept down by autocratic governments, and that's a recipe for terrorism. And in fact, when you look at where does a lot of terrorism come from, it's from autocratic governments where people don't have voice. So oil, big problem.
Yeah.
Second big problem is climate disruption. And I know this is real controversial, but in a lot of places, this is not a question that they're still fighting. They're just dealing with it because clearly the climate is changing, whether it's man-made or not man-made. You go to parts of Africa, you go to Bangladesh, and the sea levels are rising in Bangladesh, and they're forcing Bangladeshis into India. India's, in fact, built a big fence to block Bangladeshis and kills a number of Bangladeshis every year who are trying to get over that fence. And one of the areas where climate disruption is happening quite a lot happens to be on what's known as the Sudano-Sahel line, which is this line in Africa that goes straight across the country through Mali and Sudan and that whole little line, Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at where are we having terrorist problems, where is Al-Qaeda starting to hide out in Africa, it's along that line. And it's because that's also the line where Muslims and Christians met, where the Arab movement toward Muslimization of Africa stopped and the Christian animists from the south stayed. And so you have a lot of conflict that happens right along that line, and climate disruption is exacerbating it. So it's not causing the conflict, but you have ranchers and herders who can't use the same resources and start fighting, and then that fight takes on a religious dimension because they also happen to be Muslim and Christian, and suddenly Al-Qaeda enters the mix and says, hey, if you really believe in your religion, here's another way to fight it, take it worldwide. And then we have a problem. So I got into energy from that lens, that it causes national security problems because of our use of oil and because of the climate disruption. And then I also care about human security, because that's the name of the game in the 21st century is human development and human flourishing. When you have people who aren't flourishing, they're not contributing to the world. You know, Steve Jobs' dad was from Syria.
Yeah.
And I always think about, gosh, you know, what if he had been born in Syria?
Yeah.
I use an Apple computer. I have, you know, iPhones. And would we never have had any of these things? Because this person wouldn't have been able to realize his own ability. And so the energy issue we look at through all those lenses. And Drew Sloan, my co-author, is a military veteran who's spent time in these places. And the two of us together said, okay, energy in the developing world is a problem for all these reasons. We want humans to flourish. We want security for us. We don't want to feed oil states. What can we do about it? And we said, look, the way that we've tried to answer this problem through aid for 50 years, really, is big centralized generation. You know, what we have in America, you turn on a light and a light comes on, and that comes on because there's a big power plant somewhere that might be fueled by coal or it might be fueled by natural gas or something. And that allows you to have lights. And we tried to do that in the developing world, and it kept failing. Mm-hmm. And it's failed for a lot of reasons. Largely, there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of terrain issues. It's very costly to build that kind of centralized generation. If you have war or conflict, it's super easy to take down one part of a centralized system and have a blackout over a huge region. So a number of reasons why it's been hard, and we said, okay, let's look at distributed generation, which is solar panels and wind and renewable distributed generation. This is basically, you know, having energy sources that are close to your business or close to your home.
Yeah.
And then the book finally takes one more step and says, okay, if you actually want this stuff to spread, spread it through distributed, not through centralized systems. This is like personal computers rather than supercomputers. The supercomputer is a lot stronger and better and bigger. But you know what? If everyone has a personal computer, everyone has a cell phone, these small distributed systems actually can work. But how do you spread them in poor areas? And the last step we took is to say, you spread them through markets. A lot of aid has been focused on giving poor people light to read by so their kids can study by. It's a home-based system, so they give away a light bulb or something and people take them into their homes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not sustainable because it's a giveaway charity model. And people appreciate it, but there's no market force that spreads it. Whereas if you focus on business to business and use the energy to generate income, it moves from the debit side of the ledger to creating money for people. And we saw this with the cell phone revolution.
Yeah.
But it's very easy to see with energy, right? You're a barber, you have a light in your shop so you can stay open a couple hours later. You get more customers. The other barbershops say, my gosh, we'd better get a light or else we're going to close early and lose customer sales. So they get a light. All of a sudden, you start getting a market because there's a build-on effect. Everyone's getting a little wealthier. That's, you know, how markets work. And suddenly, you have light in the developing world that solves a lot of these problems.
Yeah, what I found so interesting about Let There Be Light is, on one hand, you know, you have Romney and Obama talking about their kind of big ideas and, you know, sort of their big visions for how they see the 21st century. And what both your books do is, I think, talk about how we can get there. And when I read your book, I'm a historian, and I immediately think of, I thought, and especially when you were talking, I thought of, this is sort of Bill Clinton's worldview, you know, in the foreign policy of the 1990s, talking about expanding markets and investing American hopes in sort of human dignity. And I mean, nothing could be more American. This goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. You know, this belief that liberal free trade, unleashing the capacity of the individual, this is the key to global stability and some sort of workable peace. And what this book does is says, okay, this is the big vision, right? And this is one small way that we can get there.
I had not thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right. And in fact, the next book I want to write, I'm going to New York next week to try to pitch it, is about the big vision.
Hmm.
And I think when I pitch it, I will talk a little bit more about how, you know, these connecting dots, because, you know, it's easy to have vision without a lot of substance.
Yeah.
And it's also easy to focus on just these little things, which I think you do me more credit than the books might do. You know, they focus on small problems and try to solve them, or big problems and try to solve them. But I want to build some of that connective tissue because I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, which I assume this is your co-author, Drew Sloan, with the introduction where it begins with, you know, Let There Be Light. I'm getting ready to read what I think is a substantive policy book. But we start off, which I assume when he was a soldier, looking at, a darkened, what he calls a 14th century seeming Afghan village. And seeing instead of, you know, this is a problem that needs to be dealt with, but seeing the human potential there and saying, you know, the problem is that, you know, they don't have energy. And so this book, I find this interesting talking about distributed generation. And, I mean, you've talked a little bit about what decentralized energy is, but I think talking about cell phones is, I don't know, it puts it in a more understandable way, because anyone who's been to the developing world, you're struck immediately by the how ubiquitous cell phones and cell phone stores are everywhere. And so it seems to me that's kind of the model, looking at cell phones. If we can get a cell phone in the hands of, you know, people in Africa or throughout the Middle East, why not some sort of, renewable energy source?
That's exactly right. And in fact, when we looked at the how-tos, we did a lot of study of the cell phone market. We looked at other markets too.
Yeah.
We looked at a lot of businesses that have sold to the developing world, and some of them are very counterintuitive. For instance, a Pure Water Filter, which is one of those water filter companies like Brita, tried to sell clean water to the developing world.
Mm-hmm.
Total flop, complete failure.
Hmm.
And so we investigate that case study to say,
yeah,
you can't take it for granted that people want your goods. You actually have to market them, even something as obvious as energy.
Yeah.
People don't usually want energy. They want their cell phone to work. And
yeah.
There's a little bit of a difference there, and if you're trying to market, that matters. So we looked a lot at cell phones because they were the success stories. We looked at a couple other success stories like cement in Mexico for small houses and small packets of shampoo and so on for India, and looked at how things were sold effectively in the developing world, and then we looked at some failures to figure out what could go wrong.
Yeah, and it's interesting because this is a very hard-headed and pragmatic sort of book. It's not, you talk about the 1.5 billion humans who are energy poor, and then I think you make an excellent point that it's one of those that is obvious once someone smart points it out, that 1.5 billion poor people still have an enormous amount of purchasing power. Do you want to talk about that, kind of harnessing that sort of market force?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the biggest leaps that aid and charity and doing good for the poor has made is, and it's happened in my lifetime. I remember when I graduated from college and wanted to help the developing world somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was about helping these poor victims.
Yeah.
And how do you give them something that they need? Well, the big turnaround that happened in the last decade or two is starting to say, wait, these aren't victims. They're actually buying a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
They're a huge market.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the numbers, then we compared it to the global makeup market, cosmetic market, and the global soft drink market.
Mm-hmm.
The energy market is much bigger in the developing world alone than the global market for soft drinks. So if you think about how much does Coca-Cola and Pepsi spend to market its products to get them all over the world, energy is a much bigger market. It's also poor people are spending more per capita percentage-wise than rich people are. It's like the poor in America being forced to use laundromats rather than having laundry machines in their houses, and they end up spending more money on their laundry. Same exact thing. And I remember when I was in India watching people, burn a little bit of coal for a meal and then immediately extinguishing it, trying to save the last little bit because they were spending so much money. But when you start looking at this as a market, suddenly, it's worth it to market to folks, and you design your products differently. There's a guy named Paul Polak who worked for a group called IDE who came up with the idea of designing for the bottom billion, that you start with the price that people can pay, and then you design your product based on that price rather than taking a product and trying to cheapen the product to get to a price that people could pay.
Hmm.
And it creates really interesting design changes that we're now seeing everywhere, from automobiles. Tata Automobiles has created this $2,000 car in India. And it wasn't, let's take a Mercedes-Benz and strip it. It's, let's build a car, and it has to cost no more than $2,000. And that led to engineering breakthroughs and all sorts of interesting breakthroughs that create a workable product at a cheap level.
Yeah, and to transition just a bit, I mean, I did find this interesting when you were talking about India, and it brings to mind, you talk about indoor health pollution. And this is something that, again, it's sort of like, oh, yeah, I suppose that is a real problem. But could you explain, why this matters and, how it fits with your larger argument?
Absolutely. So this is a huge issue which people don't really notice. We compare it in the book. We say, look, think about how much we're spending on malaria all around the world. We've even genetically designed a mosquito that can't carry malaria to try to kill out all the malarial-carrying mosquitoes. I mean, huge amount of effort.
Mm-hmm.
And indoor air pollution tends to kill about half as many people again as malaria per year. And how does it do that? It does it in a couple of ways. One is just lung problems and respiratory problems, exacerbating asthma, causing people who are usually women. It's usually women who are cooking over mm-hmm. small fires inside enclosed areas. They cough, they sneeze, they die at 40, and that seems like a natural death.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's a death that was caused by lung disease, exacerbated by cooking over this fire for their entire lives.
Hmm.
That's the main way it happens, and what that means is a number of things. First of all, losing moms in that era of their life is horrible for their kids.
Yeah.
You lose your main person who's raising the children in a lot of these places. They're also often co-income producers, and so families slip further into poverty. Of course, you're also losing the human potential of these women.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the labor-saving devices that have allowed women to work and contribute to society in bigger ways, of course, raising kids is a big way, but if these women were educated, they could raise their kids better. You know, there's so many ways that women could flourish, and the lack of energy is one of the things that really holds them back. So we look at that quite a lot.
Yeah, and then I think it brings you to a point and something I'd never heard of before. You talked about the Asian brown cloud. Could you talk about that just for a minute?
Sure. So this is another of these climate disruption pieces that is already happening. In a lot of Asia, they're burning firewood or other materials that have a lot of particulates in them, and that's how they get their energy. Well, what that's caused is this basically smog that's risen above the Asian subcontinent, so India, China, sometimes the southern Asian continent. And you've got a layer of what's basically smog, this big brown cloud that hovers, and it moves a little bit, but mostly over that continent. It's caused by all of the dung fires and wood fires and things that they're burning. One thing that that's all causing is deforestation, which is a whole other set of issues, but it can cause real conflict, landslides, but also conflict between people, and some horrible issues of, you know, women looking for firewood and getting raped on the way and things like that. The second thing it causes is this brown cloud, and that brown cloud is actually affecting the weather patterns because it's like having a big cloud over your over your continent, and that's affecting the growth of plants and so on, which means farmers aren't getting as much money, which so you've got a whole depressive effect on the entire economy of largely farming economies because of what they're burning to make energy, and it's not necessary. These places have a lot of wind, they have a lot of water for micro hydro, you know, small dams and things. They have a lot of solar, obviously. India is quite a hot place. And so is Bangladesh and so on. So so it's not necessary, and it's causing poverty.
Okay, so you've established the absolute need for, talking about the energy poverty, and sort of the health effects of energy poverty, the national security implications, and then we talk about you can harness market forces so that you can scale distributed energy. Okay, so and again, this all sounds very optimistic and quite doable. So I guess explain why because it all sounds like such a great idea. Why aren't we doing this already?
Well, I don't think it's because it can't be done. I remember I had a professor at Oxford who was very dismissive of a commenter who said, if this doesn't exist, then it probably can't be done. Hmm. She said, we never had an ice cream shop in Oxford until two American Rhodes Scholars dropped out of their program and started an ice cream shop. Now we have an ice cream shop. So, things can be done, and sometimes they're just not thought about right.
Yeah.
A lot of the work in distributed energy is about the business model rather than the technology.
Hmm.
And a lot of what we say in the book is, look, people are treating this like it's a technological problem, but it's not. The technology is there. It can get better. It is getting better. It can get cheaper. It is getting cheaper. What you really have is a business model problem. You have to figure out how to sell goods to the developing world in a way that works for different countries with different atmospheric conditions and different distribution chains and different ways of financing things. And you have to tackle those business model problems one by one. And we lay out about seven issues. Financing, cultural issues, man and woman power, are people educated? Can they repair things? And so on and so forth, and basically go through each one of them and say, okay, here are some financing mechanisms that you can use. Here are some ways to affect regulations. A lot of times energy is a very regulated field, and you need to change the regulations so that you don't have one monopoly that's the only people allowed to sell energy. Sometimes you need to change tariffs so that you're not, you know, doubling the price of a solar panel once it gets into your country. So we walk through each of these and we knock them down, and none of those things are easy to change. And that's why there's a lot of problems. It's hard to come up with a good business model. And some of the issues are quite political. You know, there's real power that gets lost. When you lose a lot of centralized generation, you know, there's a lot of opportunities for corruption.
Yeah.
Big amount of money going into a project.
Sure.
There's a lot of opportunities for control. A lot of countries think of energy as something that lets them control their populace. There's some cases that we cite of various dictators who turn on and off the lights as a way of rewarding various villages that they like and don't. So, so you know, there's real issues with doing it, but they're surmountable. And they were surmounted with cell phones, the exact same set of issues by and large. And you can surmount them here. You just have to kind of start tackling them and put your shoulder to the grindstone. It's not glamorous, but it's doable.
Yeah. It's not the sexy foreign policy topics that we often talk about, but these are the, seems to me, these are the things that kind of really matter. So if I'm going to try to kind of boil this down and make an argument to my, you know, 19-year-old sophomores and the foreign policy topic that's on their mind, you know, this book starts in Afghanistan, right? And they think about Afghanistan. You know, how can this make American missions, you know, in places like Afghanistan, what can this sort of, you know, 5-10 years down the road, how can this make America successful in places like Afghanistan?
Sure. So there are a couple of things that hold back the developing world. And because these countries are fragile and unstable, they hold back the rest of the world. They cause problems for the rest of the world, and they fail to contribute their human capital to the rest of the world. If America could build these energy systems in these countries, or could assist them in building the energy systems, sorry, I misspoke, that's really the way to look at it. Can we assist these countries in building these systems? The gains we get are things like countries with more education. If they have lights on, they can educate people. They don't have to stop learning at 6 p.m. when it gets dark. A lot of people work all day in these countries, including the children, and more educated populace does not necessarily lead to peace, but it does tend to lead to very good things for women particularly. Educated women is one of the biggest predictors of growth in the economy, in part because they can then educate their children. So lots of positive effects from that. You have positive health effects. A lot of the problems with diseases in these countries is that you can't get refrigeration to refrigerate pills and so on to get them to the points where they're needed. So you can easily have distributed energy that lets you have little refrigerators that you carry around. Well, suddenly you don't have the kind of health worries that we're worried about. You know, a couple of years ago we were worried about pandemic flu and SARS, and those worries are still there. The chance for those kind of diseases, we thought in 1918 it'll happen again. We've got more people in the world. So that kind of thing will make a big difference in stability. And then last, but far from least, you'll have more economic growth. It's really hard to grow a business when you can't have any energy. You see the losses from that, even in countries that do have energy, where they have a lot of brownouts and blackouts because it's not a stable grid. You know, there's only so much you can do with a treadle wheel sewing machine versus an electric sewing machine and that kind of thing. So you'll start seeing economic growth. Well, there's all sorts of positive correlations between economic growth and stability. And the final thing I think you'll see is, frankly, more democracy, which is also positively correlated with stability, that you're taking money out of the hands of oil dictators. You're reducing the ability of the Saudis to spread extremist literature and so on around the world, because they're getting less money from oil. The less we're dependent on oil for transportation. And a lot of these countries use oil-fed diesel generators. So while our electricity isn't oil-based, in a lot of the developing world it is oil-based because of the diesel generators they're using. That's also good for the world. So democracy, development, education, particularly education for women, these are big forces that stabilize the world and make America more safe too.
mean, the other half of this walnut is your other book, Advancing the Rule of Law Abroad. And if we could just transition to that, if you could just kind of begin to explain the role of the rule of law and its importance for, you know, global stability first, and how that kind of meets or intersects with American national security.
Sure. So, again, when I was in India, when I was first noticing these energy issues, I came across some instances of police corruption and aid corruption that were just enormous. So in one case, none of the aid money made it to a poor area that was supposed to get it. In another case, there was police brutality and corruption that was protecting, that was basically keeping down economic activity and helping a monopolist maintain a monopoly. And one of the things I realized was, boy, so many people in the development field are trying to help bring these countries out of poverty. But as long as people are insecure, as long as they're fearful of lawlessness, as long as they worry that all their stuff is going to get taken away, it's going to be hard for them to build. And when they physically worry for their own safety, they're not going to be as productive, and they're certainly not going to flourish. And if you look at human dignity and development and kind of the Amartya Sen manner of development as freedom, lack of security really takes away freedom, and so does corruption. And so I got interested in the rule of law set of issues. And what I realized pretty early on in studying this, the first piece I wrote in the rule of law field was a definition of the rule of law, because I realized that people were using it like it was manna from heaven. It meant everything and nothing.
You know,
the rule of law was about human rights. It was about law and order. It was about anti-corruption. It was about the efficient functioning of the judicial system. It was about treating people equally under the law. And each of those is a little bit different, actually. And you can have some and not have others. For instance, a lot of former communist countries had a lot of law and order and very little, you know, equality under the law, very little human rights. And then after 1989, that reversed. They had a lot less law and order, more freedom, and that was mixed for people. And so I realized that the rule of law was this really important issue, and that very, very few people were studying it. It kind of fell through the cracks. Development aid people didn't really like working with cops, and they particularly didn't like working with corrupt or violent cops. You know, it's just not fun if you're trying to save the world necessarily. And our military in America was ostensibly barred from doing this work, although there have been various workarounds, but since the 70s for human rights reasons wasn't supposed to do it, except in certain carve-outs. And so you had this area where it was not really foreign policy. It was seen as domestic. In fact, I wrote my dissertation on it at Oxford, and I had to really argue that this was an international relations issue.
Really?
Because it didn't fit into their, you know, it wasn't country to country.
Yeah, yeah.
It was this kind of sub-country issue. And the argument I made, which is the argument I make in the book, is, look, most of our foreign policy issues that are hardest for us to deal with now are domestic issues in other countries that affect our security and safety.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
The rule of law is one of those. And the example I gave, is, I think I start the book with it, is that when I was in Russia in 1992, the country was kind of falling apart. It just moved from the Soviet Union to Russia. And some mafiosos offered myself and my brother and some friends of ours a nuclear submarine to buy.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I was 16 years old. I really didn't have the capital to buy a nuclear submarine. But I didn't also know if I wanted a nuclear submarine, although I had sort of Beatles dreams of taking this as my way home. But we didn't know if it was a real nuclear submarine or not. There's no way to tell. But it could have been. And one of the problems with the rule of law for our security is that you get corrupt border cops letting in arms. You get corruption that can allow nuclear material to come out. We just saw basically a corrupt spy in Canada who was passing secrets to Russians. These sorts of rule of law issues have real security ramifications in a world where what other countries do internally affects our security here at home.
Yeah, I find, you know, my major kind of international experience is I work in a kind of, I would say, a democracy initiative, sort of a boot camp in Jordan every summer. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, a couple of months out of the year over there. And it seems to me Jordan is you know, quite a bit like the rest of the developing world, everyone just takes for granted that, you know, the police and every government, almost every government bureaucrat is totally and utterly corrupt. And you know, this is, you know, what happened with the Arab Spring. And so it's like Let There Be Light. It's sort of like this obvious answer that's kind of staring us right in the face. This is one of the big major problems that we don't even sort of address, it seems to me, in our kind of national security debates during at election time. And so what I found interesting about this is that, you know, your kind of inside out approach, you know, to talking about the rule of law abroad, and maybe you could kind of talk about how you approach promoting the rule of law differently than other people who have written about this.
Sure. So, and I think this is very influenced by the work that I do at Truman, which is, of course, very political. We're working with Congress. We're trying to change laws in the country. We're working with the administration. We're trying to affect how things are seen politically because that's how things get done. When I looked at how we were approaching the rule of law in other countries, and the U.S., by the way, and other countries are spending billions of dollars a year trying to fix the rule of law in other nations.
Yeah.
In fact, at one point, we were working in 183 countries, and there's only 210 countries in the entire world.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a huge issue that the U.S. is working on. It's just not, as you were saying, it's not like an above the fold on the Washington Post front page kind of issue. But we're spending a lot of money. We're doing a lot. And most of what we're doing is looking at what would we do here at home? How does our system work? Let's import that over there.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked. We've been doing it for, you could argue, we've been doing it since we started invading the Dominican Republic and so on 100 years ago, but we've been doing it in this modern way for at least 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work very well, and that's because the rule of law is an incredibly political area within a country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at America. If we want to change the laws on police sentencing, you know, or three strikes and you're out rules go up for referendum in California, do we have the death penalty or not? What counts as political corruption in our country? These are big political issues.
Mm-hmm.
And also on a small level, people really lose power. The rule of law is about choosing who has power in a society.
Yeah.
And mostly it's about taking power from powerful people and giving it to less powerful people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's real hard. I mean, that's equality under the law, but that's real hard. When we first had the concept of the rule of law in England, it was with the Magna Carta, and what it basically boiled down to was the lords, the rich feudal class, finally amassed enough power just through their money and the power that they got banding together to challenge the monarchy. And they started to bring about some rule of law, not for everybody, certainly not for their serfs, but for themselves, and it's a power game. It's about who has power in the society, how do they wield it, and how do they get a little more for themselves. That's what the rule of law, in my mind, largely boils down to, is this agreement between the government and the people about how power is to be wielded in this society. What's the relationship between the state and the society?
Mm-hmm.
When you look at it that way, it becomes incredibly domestic.
Mm-hmm.
And what another country can do is not nothing. Another country can do quite a lot, but only by working through that domestic system. So instead of looking at what should be done, you start looking at who wants to do it. Who are your reformers in this country? Mm-hmm. What do they want? What do they benefit from? Who gains and who loses from these rule of law changes that you might make? How can you amass the power to get the positive gains that you want? Who needs to come on board? How do you build coalitions? It's much more like advocacy and political work in our country or in any country, and much less like a traditional aid project where you're building a road or something. And a lot of our national security and foreign policy work needs to start walking this line, and I talk about this a little bit in the book. It's this line between traditional development approaches and traditional foreign policy approaches. Foreign policy approaches are diplomacy, right? You push on the government, you tell the government, do this. And if you push hard enough or you offer enough carrots as opposed to sticks, the government makes that decision. So when Ronald Reagan says, you know, tear down this wall, talking about the Berlin Wall, we didn't offer earth-moving equipment. We assumed that if the Soviet Union wanted to take down the Berlin Wall, they could do it. A development approach would have been to offer earth-moving equipment, right, and to ignore the politics of that.
Yeah.
Well, in most of these issues, we now need both approaches.
Hmm.
We both need to pressure the government because this is about power. And we need to help them do it, whether that's the earth-moving equipment or offering police equipment or whatever. And it's offering the technical assistance of how do you build coalitions, how do you organize to challenge power, how do you build up power among people who don't have it. So it's a both-and rather than an either-or approach, and we're not good at those two pieces of our tool set working together.
So it sounds like if – let's just use a case study of Egypt, you know, today. And, you know, the way you would go about this is sort of the traditional sort of, hey, the aid package that goes to Egypt that's been, you know, been in place since Camp David. But then quite literally relying upon NGOs to send hundreds, maybe thousands of sort of kind of development assistance, people on the ground, to literally work with Egyptians in organizing grassroots politics.
Right? You know, is that what you're talking about? That's sort of right. And it sounds real challenging when you say that, like, oh, we're going to go into other countries and organize their politics. But the key is we're not doing it ourselves. What we're doing is assisting local forces in those countries and teaching them. And that's being done by a lot of people. You know, in Egypt, for instance, the Serbians, after they threw off their dictator, they started a group that went and taught the Egyptians how to organize against their dictator. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is already happening country to country. It's not that the United States is doing it. And in fact, our best rule of law programs are not usually the United States sending people. It's usually us sending people from other countries that have done it themselves to teach other people how to do it. Because, you know, no one really wants the U.S. to wag a finger at them and tell them how to do it. And also, our system is pretty different than most systems. We're British-based. Most countries are French-based in their legal systems. Mm-hmm. We're rich. Most countries aren't so rich.
Yeah.
So it can be much more helpful for Egypt to hear how Morocco did something or how Albania did something than how we did something. And so a lot of our actual foreign policy work in this area is to bring people who have done changes successfully to these other countries to teach them. But you're right, it is mostly grassroots politics. And Egypt is a great example because, in fact, we had a rule of law program in Egypt for a long time where we were helping do things like judicial case management, very typical, very technocratic reforms, as if the only problem with the Egyptian system had been that they didn't have computers. They didn't have computers because somebody hadn't funded the courts to that degree, and someone hadn't funded the courts to that degree because someone wanted to maintain some power over the courts. And, you know, when you start looking at it that way, you realize, you know, you're nibbling at the edges of a problem that won't be solved until you solve that power equation.
So what you're talking about is, you know, U.S. policymakers looking at advancing the rule of law abroad and looking at it both at the very sort of elite kind of traditional diplomatic approaches coupled with bottom-up, you know, funding of, you know, all sorts of grassroots organizations in whatever country you're talking about. And so let's just imagine, what do you think this, like the Arab Spring, what would you think, what's a realistic but optimal outcome in the next 10 years? What would the rule of law look like in Egypt? Let's just stay with that example.
Sure. So I should caveat that it's really hard right now in the Arab Spring countries, particularly in Egypt, for instance. They've told us we don't want your aid and we don't want your NGOs.
Sure.
And, you know, so there's going to be a period of not wanting America to interfere and maybe not wanting other countries to interfere.
Sure.
That's pretty understandable given what effect we've had on their politics up until now. Eventually, hopefully, we can work with them either directly or through international groups or through international NGOs so that it's not, you know, stamped made in America.
Mm-hmm.
And what it would look like is probably more like Italy. Hmm. You know, Italy is not great on rule of law scales. If you look, in fact, there was a study that came out. I'm not going to quote the number because I can't remember it, but a large percentage of their GDP seems to be coming from illicit and mafia activities.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're basically a fair country.
Yeah.
People can get a fair shake. Business can function in Italy. You aren't worried about having things, you know, you aren't worried for your life when you walk around Italy. They've got a tourism industry.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of petty theft. There's a lot of corruption. But it's at a more manageable level.
Sure.
And the idea that you could get those a lot of the countries in the Middle East to a level like Italy is quite doable.
Yeah.
That is not a stretch. And then, you know, you would like Italy to be a little bit more like Norway and you know, some of these things you sort of work on bit by bit, and some might be impossible. You know, I believe cultural factors play a role.
Sure.
And some countries like a little less rule of law.
Yeah.
And by that I mean, if you can speed things up, some people are okay with corruption. One of the really interesting stories that I tell in the book is that in Albania, where I did a lot of work, everybody was talking about corruption. All the politicians, oh, this is horrible. We have so much corruption. This is bad. All the international NGOs, all the countries around the world that were trying to help Albania were all saying, you know, corruption is a huge problem here. But somebody was smart enough to do a test and say, well, what do you think is corruption? And they gave two examples. They said, if a flower seller raises their prices right before a big holiday, is that corruption and is that justified? Or should that person be punished? And if a student gives a bribe to a teacher for a better grade, is that corruption or should that be punished? And 2/3 of the people said the flower seller was corrupt and should be punished. And 2/3 said that the student wasn't corrupt and that it was justified if it was corrupt.
Yeah.
And the teacher too. And so you do get these cultural differences where certain things matter more to people. And you need to think about that for the rule of law. So not everyone's going to be Norway or the United States. But if we could get more countries to be Italy, we'd be in a much better world.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Well, we've taken a lot of your time up, and, you know, obviously you're busy. You're finished two books and about to start on a third. So maybe this is the general last question that we have. Just, you want to talk very quickly about your next project?
Sure. Thank you. I have not gotten to talk to anyone about it. So this is a first time. But I really think that the nature of foreign policy has changed, and the nature of national security challenges have changed in the 21st century, where we now have nation states and we have weak states and we have individual actors, whether that's businesses or really just individual people or what's basically an NGO like Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. It's basically an NGO-based organization.
Yeah.
Just didn't bother to incorporate. And so you now have a lot more actors. That's not new. Everybody's talking about that. But it means that we need a lot more tools to bear on these problems. And the U.S. government is still structured from the 1950s. If you look at the basic – one of the reasons that the Truman Project is called the Truman Project is that Harry Truman in the 1940s was the last person to innovate all of our security apparatuses. So
yeah.
The CIA, the Defense Department, the United Nations, NATO, all that was created in the late 1940s. Well, we have had a revolution in how we organize people in the business world. We've had a revolution in how we organize people online and these tools that we can now use to work across borders and so on. The U.S. government is one of the few places where that innovation hasn't taken place, particularly in the security field, in part because of security issues about how you share information and clearances and so on. So I really want to write about what would be possible to do and what would organizing our government and not just government, what would organizing our country, because I think a lot of it is going to be done by businesses and NGOs, not just the government. How do we organize that to do good foreign policy in the 21st century?
Wow. So this is, again, kind of a government reorganization for the 21st century. It sounds like a similar sort of book, you know, a book that straddles, that it's pointed more towards policy intellectuals, but is also accessible for the informed public. And
I hope so.
Yeah, no. I mean, these are both very readable, interesting books, and you know, heavy on policy, but you know, quite accessible, which is not an easy thing to do. So, you know, thank you for joining us. I urge everyone to go out and to visit Amazon or your nearest, your favorite online bookseller and pick up one or both of Rachel Kleinfeld's new books.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Yeah. This has been really fun.
Thanks, Rachel. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld and hearing more about her books, Advancing the Rule of Law Abroad and Let There Be Light. I want to urge all the listeners to go out on the internet and purchase these books, or to urge your local library to stock them so you and others can read them. I will look forward to seeing you next week. Bye.